This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with two guests who help escort women to an abortion clinic in the Bronx.
We've just passed the 38th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision that gave women the right to decide whether or not to terminate their pregnancies. Yet, this fundamental constitutional right is still under attack.
We'll hear about yet another attempt from the Vatican to deflect attention from the scandal of sexual abuse.
The evidence points more and more to the Pope and the Council for the Propagation of the Faith. Hear why.
Stay with us.
Heidi, remember a couple of years ago, Jimmy Carter wrote an amazing book called Palestine, Peace or Apartheid? And it really talked about particularly the West Bank and Gaza as an apartheid situation. And the book sold well, but Carter was heavily, heavily attacked. And so you haven't heard much more about it now, but it was a very, very significant and important book. And lately I heard there's some new news on the front of the Carter book, even though it's been out for a couple of years. And it's something about a lawsuit in Carter. What's this about?
Believe it or not, a group of disgruntled readers filed a 5 million plus lawsuit in federal court against President Jimmy Carter over this book.
Was it libel, I thought? But no, it wasn't.
They're saying it's filled with demonstrable falsehoods, omissions, and knowing misrepresentations intended to promote Carter's agenda of anti-Israel propaganda. And it's a class action lawsuit. What I want to know is, who would certify a class action lawsuit?
Who would certify? The suit is frivolous. They should probably be.
It is frivolous.
For all I know, they'll be tossed and hit with damages.
They should be sanctioned. But who are the plaintiffs in this thing?
It doesn't say. It just says. The news article I read said it was a group of disgruntled readers.
Now, their claim, legally, because I think it had a line in there, is that it was a breach of contract.
Exactly. Unjust enrichment and deceit for promoting the $27 hardcover as a work of, quote, nonfiction.
This lawsuit is, but it just shows you the lengths that these anti-Palestine people are willing to go. Oh, my God.
Right. And Simon & Schuster has called it, as you said, frivolous and without merit.
But that it even got a line in the newspaper.
I know.
It's like a piece of garbage.
I know.
Oh, my gosh. Well, Jimmy Carter did a good job on at least a good part of that book, particularly the apartheid piece.
And right. We had a piece on it, I think, when it came out a few years ago.
Yeah, we did. That's correct. So people can look it up on our archive. But there it is. Frivolous lawsuit by frivolous people, except that they're holding back Palestine.
Well, Michael and Michael, in a somewhat related case because it involves academic freedom and Middle East politics, in the New York area, listeners may have heard that a couple of weeks ago, Christopher Peterson Overton, an adjunct lecturer of political science at Brooklyn College, was scheduled to teach a Middle East politics course and was fired by the provost there. But supporters rallied, raised a little fuss, launched a campaign to reinstate him, and Brooklyn College has reinstated him unconditionally, to his credit. A New York State Assemblyman complained the academic writings of the professor on Israel and the Palestinians advocated for violence, and I think he said he advocated suicide bombers, which is absolutely incorrect.
I mean, you touch Palestine in this country with any kind of reasonableness,
you touch the third rail.
Right.
Exactly right, Michael. This was a big victory. I mean,
it was huge.
They requested the senator to write a letter, and even before we'd get the letter written, the campaign had actually won and gotten the professor reinstated.
But you know, Michael, we sent the letter anyway. A bunch of us, physicians, doctors,
prominent intellectuals,
lawyers, and others, congratulating the president of Brooklyn College for reversing the firing. It's remarkable. You know, Joel Covell was fired. Terry Ginsburg was fired. This goes all the way back 30 years. And they're very organized in picking on anybody that would have any kind of objective view of the Middle East and going after them. This is a major victory.
That's right. And Michael, I think it's important to recognize when these victories do happen, instead of just always protesting, it's nice to send a letter as you and others did.
Yeah, it was delicious, particularly since the assemblyman that spearheaded this thing was Dove
Hivkind that sponsored this.
And he's a member of the Jewish Defense League, a fascist-type organization. Originally representing not the people in Brooklyn who elected him, but the interests of Israel.
We have another update Listeners may remember that several months ago we did a piece on hydrofracking in the Delaware River Basin, and this is something that has garnered really a lot of activist support. The investment of, or I should say the waste of, thousands of gallons of water to dig deep into the shale, the ruining of the water supply, and we're talking about a water supply in the Delaware Basin that serves drinking water for over 15 million people, including New York City, as I understand it.
The Marcellus Shale also goes under New York State, and we've been able to hold them off in New York State. I think there's a moratorium. I think this lasts for 6 months, Michael, do you know? But I don't know how long we can hold them off. These are powerful interests, and what they do to the water supply was dramatically shown in that movie that was
Gasland, by Joshua Fox, which is, by the way, up for an Oscar award.
My favorite frames in that movie was when some poor guy turns on his tap water,
right,
lights a match, and the water starts on fire.
I know. That was dramatic. But anyway, the specifics just briefly of this case are the Delaware Riverkeeper Network and the group Damascus Citizens for Sustainability filed a federal lawsuit. It's against the Delaware River Basin Commission in federal district court in New Jersey, and they're challenging actions that this River Basin Commission took to allow drilling of exploratory gas wells without approval and despite a basin-wide moratorium on gas wells. It came through a technicality, and anyway, the drilling went through, and they're now going to make a few of the holes that they drilled permanent. That's what the lawsuit's about.
So people who live in Pennsylvania or in the Catskills of New York, far, far away from the ocean, are in a lot of trouble. It's going to be like if you live on the Gulf and you got sabotaged by BP.
Right, because one thing that we forgot to mention is, as you said, the fire that was caused in that film was due to all the chemicals that they put in. So the chemicals are destroying the environment.
Well, here we are on Wednesday. Most of our listeners will be hearing this program next week, and we don't know what will be the final outcome in Egypt. We're all watching it, of course, with, you know, incredible anxiety, as well as, of course, support, the fact that they're finally getting rid of Mubarak, but we don't know what's going to come. And one of our major worries is that Democracy Now!, which broadcasts all over this country, has a crew of 3 or 4 or 5 people in Cairo right now, and today, as we speak, there's tremendous amount of violence going on in the main square. Thugs, so-called pro-Mubarak thugs, are in there beating people up, particularly news people, particularly if you're Al Jazeera. But everybody, I think, is subject to being not just harassed, but much
worse.
And
didn't Democracy Now! Producers get threats?
They did, yes. Really, one of our hopes is obviously for the people of Egypt, but particularly, of course, for our friends there from Democracy Now! Who are bravely covering the ongoing efforts to get rid of Mubarak.
One of the dynamics this brings up is the fact that our government has lent so much support and continues to support this government. But what happens, as we've seen before, when it starts to fail?
There's a game plan. Other dictators like Duvalier, Suharto, there's a whole host of them that the United States has supported. When they start to slide, there's a game plan. You hold on to them as long as you can, and then you try to influence the government anyway. They had a client state in Egypt that's been that way for over 30 years. It was interesting that 20 of the Egyptian military, they're all trained in the United States, were having lunch in the Pentagon the day that the uprising started. The jet planes that flew over those 2 million people in the square yesterday were made in America. So the United States is hoping to hang on to whatever they can by even supporting the Muslim Brotherhood if they have to. But it's a huge popular revolt. It's not a revolution yet. One class hasn't been replaced by another. It's a huge revolt. It's really exciting. It's like reading the history of the Russian Revolution. These people are coming out. They're proud. They got over their fear. They're making their own institutions. Let's see where it's going. But so far, so good.
Michael, I didn't say so far, so good. Today is the day when the people are starting to be beaten up. And one of the possible scenarios here is the military takes it over. And then we don't know if it's so far, so good, because the military is very close to the Israeli military. And I just actually read a report, I don't know how accurate, but that Israeli planes have just landed in Cairo carrying tear gas used to disperse crowds. Today was the day where I would not say so far, so good. Up till today, I would have said so far, so good. But today, as we were talking earlier and you mentioned, the game plan that you mentioned is they let it slide to a point, and then the U.S. comes in really backing the military to take it over and impose order, and that order will be most likely a U.S.-imposed order?
That depends on whether the officer class in the military can keep control over the rank and file in the military. And those are the people who have connections with the other common class people in Egypt. So I think it's open. It's in flux. We certainly hope that a leadership comes to the fore that can put it in the right direction. There is a great fear. I totally agree with you, because the bad guys are organized. And we don't know how well the good guys are organized. So we just don't know. But getting 2 million people in the square, it's a historic event in the entire Middle East. It's had repercussions in many other countries. Stay tuned. This is a game changer in geopolitics.
I agree with that, Michael.
Earlier this year, the Vatican revised its internal procedures for purportedly making it easier to discipline sex abuser priests. Critics of the revisions claim that the Vatican merely tweaked the process and still failed to hold bishops accountable for abuse by priests on their watch. The revisions also failed to require the reporting of sexual abuse to the authorities. To talk more about this, we're joined today by Center for Constitutional Rights attorney Pam Spees. On the telephone, we're joined by Barbara Blaine, founder of SNAP, Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. SNAP is the nation's oldest and largest self-help organizations for victims of clergy sexual abuse. Welcome, Barbara and Pam, to Law and Disorder.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Barbara, before we get started with the specifics about the new Vatican rules, can you tell us what SNAP is and your involvement?
Well, SNAP is a now worldwide movement of survivors, and my involvement is that I actually started SNAP and am the president. We are survivor-based, and we invite supporters to join us. And we have approximately 10,000 members. The vast majority are from the United States, but we do have members from across the globe.
So that you have 10,000 members, and most of those people are survivors?
Yes. Some are spouses or family members, but most are survivors.
And survivors of what exactly?
Survivors of sexual abuse by priests or other clergy members, sometimes by religious brothers, by nuns, by deacons, even bishops.
When did you form?
We actually started SNAP back in 1988. We grew in 2002 and 2003 as the headlines across the United States were exploding with stories of abuse by priests.
And tell me a little bit about what people have been able to do in the organization. I mean, there's everything from psychological counseling to complaints about the priests to getting prosecutions. I mean, I'm sure there's many different things that have gone on, court cases, settlements. Can you give us some overall picture of what it looks like right now?
Sure. We're basically a survivor-based movement, and we don't hold out that we are experts. We are the survivors. What we model ourselves using self-help model. We try to learn all we can about the impact of the abuse upon us and how to prevent others from being abused the way we were. And so what happens is that in day-to-day life, we have support group meetings, like in the United States, probably in about 65 different cities. And those meetings are usually held monthly. One of the things we've learned over time, because obviously we didn't know at the beginning, you know, 20 years ago, what we know today, and we were extremely naive, not to mention wounded, and just trying to figure out how to make it from day to day. But one of the big things we learned is that while we cannot go back and reclaim our innocence, we can't go back to being 12 or 13 years old again, but it's empowering and healing for us if we can be involved in protecting someone else who's 12 or 13 today or even in the future, to protect them from being abused.
A lot of allegations have come out about individual priests, about parishes, the Pope, the Vatican, et cetera. And, of course, that's what really brought it to public attention of not just your interviewers here, but worldwide and certainly all over this country. So we had a huge splash of press, you know, daily almost. And I think one of the reasons we felt it was important particularly to talk to you now is because we don't see that anymore. And yet, of course, from what I know, a lot of the issues haven't been resolved. So you can give us some sense of what's going on now with regard to the Vatican, the Pope,
where these where, if there's cases where they are there changes in the rules which we read about, just some sense of that, and then we'll bring Pam into the conversation because that's when sort of Pam started getting involved with SNAP.
Well, I think what's happened is that some documents were released starting in 2009 in Ireland, and those were the results of government investigations into the allegations of priests and other religious figures sexually abusing children. As these results of these investigations were made public, people were shocked, but victims found themselves empowered and recognized that they weren't alone, which gave many the courage to speak up and report their own abuse. So then what happened is that victims across Europe, you know, in Germany and in Belgium and Austria and Netherlands and England and all over Europe just started speaking out and reporting their abuse, and one thing led to another, and eventually in Ireland at the end of 2009, four bishops were resigning their positions, and the Pope has issued statements and, you know, supposedly adopted a new policy. From our perspective, what comes out of the Vatican is a lot of lofty words and empty promises. If you look for concrete action, you'll see very, very little, if any.
Pam, you're an attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and you've been working with Barbara in some capacity. Why don't you tell us how that began and what your thinking is now on these issues?
We joined a conversation with SNAP about looking for ways of to ensure accountability for what's going on. I mean, one of the things that's been happening is that the civil cases brought in the U.S. have yielded a lot of information and a lot of the documents that are now informing, you know, what we know about the scope, you know, or a systemic problem within the church that allowed for this stuff to continue happening and actually fostered it on such a widespread scale. And so it's one thing to fight it in individual cases. It's another to how do you get, is there a legal framework that gets at the widespread nature of this? You know, we're talking about massive numbers of victims for years. I mean, there's one book out that discusses the 2,000-year-old paper trail of sexual abuse in the church. So we were sort of brought into this discussion to help SNAP figure out how do you get at the larger issues here and not just fight it in an individual sort of atomized case-by-case basis, because there is a larger system here. And you know, so, you know, I think certain aspects of international law speak to this and can come into play. What I would say about the new rules and these sort of periodic efforts by the church, attempts or appearances at addressing the issue, which fall so short, because you'll hear things like cardinals or even the Pope attempt to make apology, and it's basically they're saying they're sorry for what happened to these folks. They're not acknowledging that it didn't just happen. There were, you know, that there was responsibility and that should be shared throughout the church for allowing this atmosphere and this climate. You've seen, and I guess going back to 2001 or 2002, Barbara, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it was in the early 2000s where, you know, there was an effort made to reorganize how the church was dealing with allegations of sexual abuse, and everything was supposed to be routed through to the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and that was headed by, at the time, Cardinal Ratzinger.
That's the old office of the Inquisition,
exactly.
Right? And that's
right.
In Rome, and that's where Ratzinger was, right?
Right. There are documents, letters, things coming out, you know, even after that attempt was made to ostensibly address what was happening, that really show, again, a lack of attention and a lack of awareness of the gravity of what's going on and a prioritization of the church protecting itself and its power rather than ensuring the protection of kids in the church and others in the church who are vulnerable to abuse by priests and others. And so this latest round of proposed rules, it looks like, you know, another effort, to, again, sort of sidestep the core issue, which is accountability. The church has shown repeatedly it can't be trusted to police itself. And what it also looks like is an attempt to sort of decentralize now the responsibility. So it was centralized very clearly, and now it looks like an attempt to decentralize and sort of spread it out and get it away from Rome one can assume a lot of things about that.
Can you explain procedurally how these cases are brought, where they're brought, and is there a possibility for, say, a large class action?
There have been a number of civil cases that are brought in the U.S., and they're brought under, you know, tort law. Increasingly, you know, we know of at least one or two cases that have been brought under the Alien Tort Statute, which allows non-citizens to use U.S. courts to do this. But in terms of getting at the bigger picture and framing it as a wider spread human rights violation, you know, well, there are several key legal experts out there who have discussed this as a crime against humanity. You know, and crimes against humanity, the hallmarks being that these are acts that are committed as part of a widespread or systematic assault or attack on a civilian population, and it fits. It's hard, I think, for some folks to get their mind around the Pope or others, high-ranking officials within the church, as, you know, perpetrators. But that's essentially, when you're talking about the massive sustained harm that is being caused here and the lack of awareness and acknowledgement of that gravity, it's really astonishing.
Pam, what would be the venue for a suit on a crime against humanity, and who would be the defendant?
Well, as far as venue, you know, you've got a number of countries which have what is called a universal jurisdiction scheme. Spain is one, Germany is another, which allows them to prosecute crimes that are considered among the gravest and most serious of concern. Serious war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. The International Criminal Court is another possible venue that has jurisdiction over crimes against humanity. And the issue here is when you have an institution like the Vatican, which has a global presence, the church has a global presence, and it's got varying political influence around the world, it's not beholden to anyone. It considers itself, you know, the Holy See as its own state. And it has ratified conventions like the Convention on the Rights of the Child, but it can't be held accountable in the same way states are. There are no internal checks and balances. There's absolutely no way other than to go to these other fora to get your hands around the actual problem.
Barbara, I want to go back to you on the issue of what happens with complaints, either today or what's happened in the past. Let's say there's a current complaint. It's very hard to do, obviously, if it's a 12- or 13-year-old child. What happens when that complaint goes to the church, or what happens in some of your people for complaints that happened 20 or 30 years ago when they take it back to the church? Has there been a shift? Is it a significant shift? Is it just vary so much that it's hard to describe? Can you just give us some sense of that?
Well, I think, first of all, it's really important to recognize two things. Number one is that most child victims are not able to report until they are well into adulthood. So most of us didn't tell at the time when the abuse was happening, and we didn't tell before statutes of limitation ran out, which is for another whole discussion, but maybe why statutes of limitation should be eliminated the same way they are for murder and some other crimes. The other thing to recognize is that we as victims, for the most part, are devout Catholics, and it's really incredibly difficult for us to comprehend that someone in a position of authority in the church would not want us to be protected. Pam made a very important point when she talked about, in a sense, the enablers who allow these predators to not only abuse one or two children, but then transfer them where they can abuse more children. And so for us as a survivor movement, it was difficult for us to get our heads around and to comprehend that church officials understood and were well aware that the negative impact that sexual abuse causes upon a child. It was heartbreaking and devastating to learn that policy of the church officials is to protect the predators and their assets and their reputations, not the children. And that came out loud and clear in these reports that came out of Ireland, as well as, and by the way, that's only two reports out of Ireland, and from all of the United States, there are a total of 6 grand jury or attorney general reports of investigations into these crimes. By and large, PM is right. These church officials who have engaged in the cover-up and the enabling of the predators have not been held accountable. And somehow, it's a belief and a practice within the church that they are held above the law of the various nations where these crimes have occurred. They're accountable to no one, and that it's okay for them to continue to commit these crimes. And unfortunately, it's not just the church officials who act on this. I mean, right now in Germany, the government's investigating, and they've established what they're calling a round table to look into it. But they've invited the actual criminals, I would call them the criminals, although they don't see it this way, they've invited the bishops and the church officials to sit at the round table to help figure out the crimes. And in some ways, it's a little better in Belgium, but in Belgium, Parliament is now investigating or deciding what should be done.
Well, Belgium had that great raid, right? I mean, didn't they raid some?
Right, but apparently, it was determined to not be lawful.
Oh, they raided a bishop's house or something? I forgot. Archbishop's house?
They raided the bishop's conference of Belgium, where all the head bishops of the country were meeting. They actually held them for, it's reported 8 or 9 hours, and that they questioned them. They confiscated computers and cell phones and files and documents. You know, one court has already ruled in Belgium that none of that would be admissible for bringing charges. But the bottom line here is that we need to stop having church officials at all in the business of investigating crimes. And these criminals and the enablers, just the predators and the enablers, need to be held accountable in every country according to the civil laws, which obviously do not permit molesting and raping children.
Hey, let me ask you this. Cardinal Ratzinger, when he was head of the essentially Inquisition, has now ascended and is now the Pope. What do you see as his role in this and his eventual role as a defendant?
For instance, one could say in international criminal law there is superior responsibility anticipated in international criminal law for failing to take action to prevent crimes against humanity. And there's plenty to show that Ratzinger knew and actually intervened in specific cases to protect or delay processes with respect to individual priests. That's becoming more and more established through some of these cases. That's the way the international criminal legal approach is framed. But it's so ironic because there was news recently about the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops intervening again around birth control and trying to prevent birth control from being considered preventive care, which would enable women not to have to pay out of pocket for that. And there's just this preoccupation and obsession with controlling women's sexuality and the sexuality of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender folks, and the church has no attention to addressing its own. So, the irony here is just it is something. But again, I think it's been proven over and over that the church cannot be trusted to police itself, and it is skirting efforts for accountability.
Barbara, I have a question. Since founding SNAP, what would you say has been your proudest accomplishment, and in the road ahead, what is your greatest challenge?
Well, I think the biggest accomplishment is seeing survivors who have suffered for years, decades in secrecy and shame find their voice and speak up and just report the atrocities that they endured by being raped and assaulted by priests. And I suppose the biggest obstacle, I think, is fear that we as victims feel that we have not been able to report and name our predators. It's so incredibly painful and embarrassing and all the rest to tell about these crimes, but the vast majority of victims still do not report. I would say kind of a secondary issue is the fact that when Pam mentioned that many cases have been brought in the U.S., that's very true, but at the same time, the numbers of cases are very rare when you look at the full number of victims. By and large, most states in the U.S. prohibit us from bringing our lawsuits because by the time we're able to report our abuse, the statutes of limitation have run and we're prevented from having our day in court. In a sense, it's almost like a double whammy. It's heartbreaking and devastating that we aren't able to get our day in court, but it's more devastating to recognize that our perpetrators are then able to get away with the crime because they are empowered to remain out there, and most, as we know, do reoffend. I mean, in the U.S., less than 2% of our predator priests were criminally indicted and convicted.
When you said 2%, I just want to clarify. If the John Jay study was 5%, it could be as high as 11%. When you said 2% were prosecuted, what you mean is 2% of the 5,000.
Less than 2% of the 5,000 that they are willing to admit to. We would suggest that there's many more predators that they're not admitting to because of all kinds of reasons. For example, they choose to not include priests who if victims reported prior to 2002. I don't believe we're included in the study, and I think the religious priests are excluded. So, meaning those who belong to a religious congregation, you know, like the Jesuits or the Dominicans or Franciscans, and those types are not included in these numbers. So we believe, and it's fair to say, that those are extremely conservative. And out of those numbers, very few have been convicted.
What do you think the relationship is of celibacy to the general problem?
I would say that it may be a contributing factor to the culture of the secrecy and the silence, but I would not want to blame that on the or give that as an excuse for why these priests are doing this.
You say it's systemic. Why systemic? What is it that's causing this? You don't see this in other institutions, do you?
I would suggest that the Roman Catholic priests have a belief and a commitment that once you're ordained a priest, you're a priest forever. And so I think that what happens is that that in other institutions and organizations, when someone rapes a child, they get fired. And in the church, they not only don't get fired, they frequently get promoted. But at a bare minimum, they remain in the ministry or they remain within the employment. And I think they get away with it or that it continues because they can, because no one's holding them accountable and stopping them. And anytime there's power that's unchecked, I think it expands and evil grows if it's permitted to.
That's right. And I think my comments go to that because in terms of this unchecked power, and one of the things that happens or has traditionally happened when an incident is brought to the awareness of people within the church is that the walls close behind the people who are reporting it, the families who are reporting it or the parents. And what happens is they come within this veil of secrecy and confidentiality. They're locked into it at risk of excommunication. Victims and family members of victims are threatened with excommunication in a way that the abusers are not. Ever. I don't think we know of any instance where someone has been excommunicated for having committed these offenses. And the other thing is we often talk about it in terms of sexual abuse, and I think that has a shape or a form when people think of it that is somehow separate or apart from sexual violence or rape. It's also, you know, sexual violence and rape have come to be known also as torture in international criminal law. I mean, these are very serious offenses, and, you know, as much as possible when I'm talking about it, I'm trying to talk about it in terms of violence and less so about abuse. And the other thing about the unchecked power is that I think the church has always assumed it will always be this way, that it will always exist above and beyond the law. And so what has happened is there is a paper trail because there are many documents they assumed would never see the light of day outside of its confines. And so there are actually, you know, rules about keeping safes in, you know, and lockboxes, and certain types of documents go into those. The effort on the part of the Belgian law enforcement agents was key, but that needs to be happening everywhere. That the documents that really establish the knowledge and the offenses they actually exist. And just one more thing, I have to say that I was lucky enough to attend a conference that SNAP puts together, and it was one of the most moving events to see survivors of all ages coming together and in a space like that. And the feeling there was just really incredible because it is people who have had to work really hard to reclaim their lives. I think SNAP has done an incredible thing.
Well, thank you, Pam. And Barbara, you know, I want to, the little bit I've known you and the work of SNAP, I want to share what Pam has said. But I also want you to tell our listeners, I know SNAP has a website and how to get more material. What is your website, Barbara?
It's at snapnetwork.org.
Snapnetwork.org.
There's also a website that tracks a lot of this. It's called bishopaccountability.org.
When people are looking for action from the Pope, they should be looking for not for lofty words, but action like the Pope opening up his files and turning them over to police and putting the names of the known predators on a website so that others will know to keep their children away from these guys.
Barbara, thank you.
Good to have you.
Thank you so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Politics of abortion continue to divide the country as nearly 38 years have passed since the Roe v. Wade decision. January 22nd marked the landmark decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to legalize abortion. Tens of thousands of women have been saved from death and serious injury since it became legal in 1973. Will legal abortions be attacked by the new Congress? Representative John Boehner and 50 supporters seek to codify the Hyde Amendment with the No Taxpayer Funding for Abortion Act. Listeners may recall our interview with Rhonda Copeland, who filed a nationwide class action lawsuit that stopped Hyde from taking effect in 1976. It would have prohibited Medicaid-funded abortions for poor women. Both sides of this controversial issue will be heard during this anniversary. Meanwhile, the long-standing clash between anti-choice people and abortion clinics continue. In a Bronx abortion clinic, for example, National Lawyers Guild legal observers and others monitor the threats against escorts or anyone interfering with those going into the clinic. We talk today with Guild observer Christina Lee on the telephone, and in the studio we're joined by abortion clinic escort Elizabeth Maloney. She's a member of Radical Women and led a delegation of Radical Women members to Jackson, Mississippi, to defend the last abortion clinic. In 1984, the group helped get the first conviction of a firebomber. Welcome, Christina and Betty, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'd like to start by talking specifically about the Bronx Abortion Clinic and efforts to safely escort women there and protect them from protesters. Can you tell us a bit about what's happening and how long it's been going on?
Okay, it's been over 5 years that the clinic has been attacked, you know, by the right wing. And the groups that are out there are funded by Chris Slattery. He runs about 26 of these crisis pregnancy centers, false clinics, throughout the different boroughs, and also by the Catholic Church. And they bring in interns during the summer. They pay them to stay in apartments, give them room and board. So there's religious rightists out there praying, harassing women, yelling at women as they enter the clinic, and also yelling at their partners as they enter the clinic, like saying to the men, you know, you're not a real man. You know, they say, you know, and they yell at the women, you know, we have alternatives. They have an ultrasound truck set up, which has no medical staff on board. You know, there's not doctors reading those sonograms, and yet they will give false information saying that your pregnancy is fine.
Slater, is that the guy's name? He runs what we're calling, you know, false clinics.
Right.
That's one kind of place, and those are spread out the boroughs, and I presume they are in other states as well.
Right.
Then there's this clinic, which is a place where a woman can go and get an abortion, right?
Right.
And what's it called?
It's Dr. Emily's Women Health Center.
Okay.
Thank you for clarifying that. And it's very much geared, you know, towards women. It provides all gynecological services to women.
And Slater's people, who he trains, et cetera, not only run these false clinics, but they come to Dr. Emily's clinic and do what you're saying, right?
Yes. And they particularly...
Chris Slattery, okay.
And they particularly target the Bronx. You know, they're heavy... The heaviest demonstrations have been against clinics for women, have been in the Bronx.
Why is that, Betty?
Well, I think the Catholic Church has made it a goal. There was that recent article where the, you know, religious leaders were talking about the high rate of abortions that are going on in the Bronx. And we went to myself, you know, I'm part of Radical Women and also the Clinic Defense Committee. I went down and testified at the hearings around that the city council held in order to regulate these so-called crisis pregnancy centers. And 75% of the people that were opposed to regulations have been in front of Dr. Emily's clinic. So it is, you know, being targeted. It's the poor, you know, it's a poor neighborhood. It's the outer borough, you know.
Now, do these demonstrations go on every day at the clinic?
Yes, every day that they have, that there is abortions planned at that clinic. And we go up there. We particularly have been trying to...
We being who?
The Radical Women, who's part of the coalition. Right. But the coalition is called New York Coalition for Abortion Clinic Defense. And there's many different individuals and other groups that are involved in this. And there's men and women out there defending this clinic. You know,
and you escort the women?
Into the clinic to make sure that their partners aren't harmed, too, if they're going out for a break while they're waiting for their, you know, for the woman to see a doctor.
How close are the protesters to the clinic?
Well, they don't follow any laws. There is a clinic access law. And they're supposed to stay behind barricades and be 15 feet away.
15 feet.
But the response from the police is, in the Bronx, there's only one law, and it's our law. So, you know, there has been this law passed by the city council, but the training and the trickling down of the enforcement of that law has not taken place in the city. And, you know, when we get that kind of response...
So you're telling me that the police are not there... to keep the pro-lifers from harassing individuals who go in with their partners.
Yes. Now, some... they're
Yeah, not at all. You know, I have been doing legal observing up at the clinic probably for the last 5 or 6 months now, partly because some of the escorts had been threatened by some of the, you know, anti-choice activists. And one thing that we have noticed is that the police are very hands-off. There is a slight range in the sense that occasionally there will be an officer who comes by who's assigned, who says, they shouldn't be here, this is ridiculous. But I think even those officers feel like there's not really a lot that they can do. And typically the officers who are more sympathetic tend to be women. But we've also seen officers who have been very, very chummy with the anti-choice activists. They've basically turned a blind eye. As radical law student, there's the contradiction of, you know, how much can you really rely on the police? If you call the police, there is always the chance that someone could get shot. That's a reality.
Can you paint the scene for us a little bit? I'm someone that's at get off a subway. I want to go to Dr. Emily's clinic. There's barricades, I guess, 15 feet outside the clinic. There's a few blocks I have to walk. Are there people coming up to me, harassing me? Are they yelling? What's actually happening there?
We have vests on that indicated that we're escorts. And we're stationed both in the front door and in the back door by the parking lot. We are going up to people and meeting them, you know, when we see them and advise them of their rights, that all they have to do is tell these folks that really want to shut down the clinic and want to harass them to get away. Once you say that, they're supposed to move away. We also try and act as a sort of a guard against them by putting ourselves between them, the right wing, and the women. They will go also to the subway stations and leaflet, and they will also try and follow people like their partners who might be going out to the store to get a snack or coffee. They will follow them and try and say to them, why are you allowing this to happen? You know, this and this, and they give them flyers. So we have to be very vigilant out there to keep monitoring the direction of the subways and people coming from it.
Well, let's pretend that one of these right-wingers gets in your face and says that you're murdering babies. What do you say to these people?
Well, a lot of times it's not worth it to interact with them because they have their own thought process on that whole thing. So what we will do, though, is put a sign up in their face as close as possible to block them for saying those words to the women or to the rest of us. We try not to, you know, really to engage them and just to try and turn our backs, you know, with signs to them.
Now, is Dr. Emily's the only clinic in the Bronx that you know of that does abortions?
No, there is a Planned Parenthood nearby, but it's more protected in terms of its location.
Christina, I have a question. Do we have Guild legal observers up there?
We do, and, you know, it's an unusual situation for us, but we're there supporting the women who go to the clinic and basically trying to observe the police and to figure out how are they enforcing the laws, are they enforcing the laws, and what's their response. And largely, we've seen that there hasn't really been a response from the police. And I think it's also important to acknowledge that, you know, even if people are just out there praying, which, on, you know, there are quiet days when there's just, there are women who are out there praying, it does still create an atmosphere, not necessarily fear for the women who come in, but it's a deterrent. It can be a deterrent. And that also makes space for other activists who go out. There are Franciscan monks who go out there who are much more vocal. And
wait, there Franciscan verbally, monks go there?
As protesters?
To object?
Yes.
They not just to object, but I mean, I will say, this experience has changed my view of Franciscan monks completely. Because, you know, some who are out there who are very vocal and very abusive verbally to the escorts and really aggressive in a way that I just didn't realize was possible for monks.
Betty, have you ever been subject to that?
Yes.
What's happened?
Well, that the person, one of the priests up there who's, I say he's doing sexual harassment towards women and us. He will say, you're out here and you're angry because you've never been loved by a real man.
I find this so repugnant in terms of invasion of privacy and personal choice. And I'm so thankful that you are doing this. How do you get volunteers?
Well, tell us. I want to go up there and help you. How do I get
too
up there, Betty, Christina? Mm-hmm. What do we do from Radical Women, the New York Lawyers Guild? How do all of us get in touch with you and come to your aid?
Well, you can, you know, go on Facebook for the New York Coalition for Abortion Clinic Defense, and you can also call Radical Women, which is 212-222-0633, or email Radical Women, which is nycradicalwomen@nyct.net. And it's located on 560 Southern Boulevard, the clinic. Dr. Emily Women's Health Center is 560 Southern Boulevard in the South Bronx, and you just take number 6 to East 149th Street. Or you could take the bus, the Bronx bus 19. And we're out there every Saturday from 8 until 12 o'clock, because by then the right wing has left the premises.
If you're a law student, a lawyer, or a legal professional, and you want to get involved in this, you could certainly be a clinic escort, or you could also contact the city chapter of the National Lawyers Guild at nlgnyc@igc.org. If you haven't already been to a legal observer training, then, you know, attend one and come join us. We're, the legal observers are typically out there from 9 to 12 on Saturdays, and I've really been trying hard to get a regular schedule because it is, it's up in the Bronx, and for law students sometimes it's hard to get up that early when you've been studying all night or whatnot, but it's really important to be out there, I think. Defending women's rights to have access to health care is what basically this is. You know, it's reproductive freedom and it's access to health care, and amazing to me that this is even a debate, that people are even debating whether or not abortion is legal or should happen. To me, sort of unconscionable.
It is unconscionable, but, you know, it's interesting. It's 38 years, and that's one of the reasons, of course, we wanted to talk to both of you, is because it's been around, it'll just be, when people hear this, just after 38 years of Roe v. Wade, which was January 22nd, 73, that basically said it's a woman's choice about deciding whether to terminate a pregnancy or not. And yet we're sitting here with you guys having to do this to defend really what is considered to be, by the court even, fundamental constitutional rights of a woman. And I'm interested in where you see that struggle going now. This, obviously, in the Bronx isn't just an isolated instance. There's other places in the country. We have a Congress that is still, the new one particularly, but is still going after this. I know there's issues around how supportive Obama has been. So either of you, just tell us a little bit about where you see things going politically, this administration, Congress.
Well, one of the things I think it's important to emphasize, no matter what laws are passed, whether they're against us or for us, the only way they're going to be enforced is through the movement. And that's by feminists, and that means men and women coming out to defend the rights. And we've organized, you know, which you'll be hearing about, and hopefully individuals that listen to your show will have already read about it, that on Saturday, January 22nd, there's going to be a big demonstration in front of Dr. Emily's clinic from noon to 2 p.m. And a number of different groups have mobilized. And this whole fight that's going on in the Bronx is a catalyst for groups to come together. And I think that's the important thing we have to remember. We will get bad laws on the books, and we will get good laws on the books. But it's going to be up to us in the climate that we live in order to defend those. We have to come out on the street and demand our rights. You know, we have access to abortion, but we have to be at Dr. Emily's clinic to demand it.
I think that's very important. Christina?
I think it's important, too, for people to realize just how far towards the right this issue and things in general, frankly, have been pulled. I agree with Betty that no matter what's happening, really, or what we think might happen with laws and with legislation, the most important sort of force behind shifting things back towards where they need to be, towards the left, is going to be people taking it upon themselves to do something about it. And I think that, to their credit, the conservative forces and the religious right have been very good at this.
Betty, has there been a decline in the number of abortion clinics in New York City, to the best of your knowledge?
I think there has been, and I know, like, you know, in New Jersey there has definitely been. There was a recent article on that. Access is, you know, more limited. And also, if you're an immigrant and you're poor, it's always limited. You know, if you're rich and wealthy, you can always get an abortion in whatever state in this country. But if you're poor, you know, it's more difficult. And I think one of the things, too, that as a feminist, we have to link the whole issue of abortion, you know, talk about it in terms of reproductive justice, reproductive freedom. You know, when we're out there, we're talking about the need to defend child care. We talk about the need that women need to have a living wage, that we're opposed to forced sterilization, either for, which still happens, you know, as a result of racism, as a result of economic reasons, that women feel that their only choice is to have to be sterilized. So we really need to make a broad definition of reproductive freedom and also link our struggle to other struggles, what's going down. When the whole thing, the attack that the FBI, the raids, you know, was raiding activists.
The ones in Minneapolis and Chicago.
Right.
Right.
When I was defending the Everett Washington clinic and we got the first conviction of a firebomber out there, that was in 1983. A long time ago, they were trying to, the firearms tobacco folks that were involved weren't doing their job. So we used to have press conference and call them out that they're not doing their job, they're not arresting this person, and really embarrassing them. And what happened eventually is that the trial was almost going to be turned out on its head, and they were going to investigate me as one of the leaders of the defense. So we have to link our struggle and our defense of all activists and all the issues, you know, that are for equality and for a better life together in order to win any issue.
Betty, tell us a bit about Radical Women.
We're a socialist feminist group, and we've been around from 1967. And since those days, we've always, we've talked about abortion rights in the broad sense of the word. One of our demands is for 24-hour child care. We, are opposed to forced sterilization, looking about, when we go back to the roots, looking at what's happened to Native American women, to Puerto Rican women, and also that Congress only failed by one vote to sterilize all Japanese women that were interned. So you have to realize that government doesn't mind sterilizing women, but they're afraid, they're not willing to pay for abortion. So we've been involved, on this issue since our beginning. We're based in New York City at 113-128th Street in Harlem. And, we've been involved in this issue and other coalitions presently, like in San Francisco, there's a big fight. They have a March for Life out there, and Radical Women is part of a coalition that's working to defend abortion out there. We have a branch in Australia, and they've also faced off with the Priest for Life, which is the Franciscan brothers that are out in front of our clinic. They're also in Australia in their movement. And they faced off against them in defense of abortion and trying to win, abortion rights there in Australia.
Christina, are there any final thoughts you want to leave our listeners to as to where this issue is some, 38 years after the Supreme Court's ruling?
No one is immune from the conservative forces in this country. We have to look at legislation, and we have to, again, look at the religious rights on grassroots movement and meet that call. And if people aren't coming out about abortion, then they better be coming out about something, making some effort somehow to shift things back to where they need to be so that we have more equality, so that we're able to actually fight for human rights for everyone. It isn't enough anymore, I think, to just, I don't know if it ever was actually, but it's really not enough to just live your own life responsibly and well, although I think that's an important thing that all people should do. People really need to be stepping out, maybe getting a little bit outside of their comfort zone or doing something that they haven't done before in order to say, look, what's happening now, whether it's abortion, whether it's the loss of civil liberties, whether it's the attacks on immigrants, that all of these things are wrong and that I need to do something about it. And not just that, but I need to make space for other people to be able to come out with me as well. And certainly if you're a lawyer or a law student or a legal professional, I would definitely encourage people to look into the National Lawyers Guild at nlg.org. It's really been a great resource for me as a radical law student and a really great guiding force, as I'm sure Heidi knows.
And I think for all our listeners, we've talked particularly about an incredibly wonderfully active group here that protects women who want reproductive health care. But I'm sure in our listeners throughout the country, there are clinics that need that kind of protection all over. And so I urge people to find out where those groups are and to get active on those issues.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
That was excellent.
Really. If you want to hear Law and Disorder again or hear a segment you've missed, go to lawanddisorder.org. on the web. Now you should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Become a friend and send Law and Disorder to your friends through Facebook.
If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.